It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. If you watch sports, there is a good chance you've seen ads, logos, and other promotions for online sports gambling companies.
New customers bet $5 to get 200 instantly in bonus bets and a month of NFL Plus Premium.
New customers bet $5 to get 250 in bonus bets if you win.
Get up to a $1,500 new customer offer in bonus bets when you sign up now. Download and bet today.
But it hasn't always been that way. Before 2018, sports betting was mostly illegal, with the exception of some in-person sports books, mostly in Las Vegas. Things changed with a U.S. Supreme Court ruling that opened the doors for states to legalize gambling on sports. Now, over three dozen states have some kind of legal sports gambling, and online sports books like FanDuel and DraftKings, they're big business. That has raised concerns about the impact on sports and especially the risk of problem gambling. Jonathan D. Cohn talks about those risks in his new book. It's called Losing Big, America's Reckless Bet on Sports Gambling. He's a program officer at the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and he talked with Rob Ferret about the rise of sports betting and Wisconsin's unique situation.
Let's go back to 2018. We got this Supreme Court decision that really changes the landscape for sports gambling in the United States. Can you talk about this new chapter, as you call it?
Yeah, so this is a dangerous question to ask a historian, but I'll take you back to sort of a short version of the history, which is that in the late 1980s, early 1990s, states were threatening, basically, to legalize sports gambling on their own, and Congress said no. Congress in 1992 passes the Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act to protect all of our athletes and our young people, of course. What that bill did, it did not make sports gambling illegal, but it banned states from legalizing sports gambling. So on that basis, in 2018, was the Supreme Court decision that you mentioned, which rendered PASPA illegal or unconstitutional because Congress can't tell states what to do, rendering that sports gambling is a states' rights issue and states should be free to decide the issue of sports betting for themselves.
So here it is with the states now. I want to put Wisconsin in the conversation for a moment. I was just brushing up on my Wisconsin Constitution. There's a pretty strong gambling ban with some exceptions in the Constitution. So we haven't joined states in legalizing online sports betting. But hang on, asterisk, we've got tribal sovereignty and there is sports gambling, sports books in person at tribal casinos. How unique is that in the country with how states have tackled things since the Supreme Court decision?
Yeah, it's fairly unique. Most states, I think 30 plus states, as of this conversation, it changes like every week. Most states have legalized sports gambling, have legalized online sports gambling. Wisconsin is unique. There are a few other upper Midwestern states in the same category that have legalized sports betting, but for whatever reason, have not gone all the way, have not gone all in, pun intended, to legalize online sports gambling. They see that as sort of the last bridge, or maybe a bridge too far even.
And people may wonder, well, hold on, the internet, how it right. Doesn't stop at the state borders. How does the state say, no, you can't gamble here, even though if you cross that state line, you can gamble online there?
The internet doesn't stop at state borders, but it actually kind of does. DraftKings and FanDuel and all the other online providers of sports betting all partner with geolocation companies that have really, really precise location measurements on every single cell phone when you're using the app. And there are reports that even if you step across the border from Florida into Georgia, you know, they can pick up on the fact that you're over the border and they can cut you off because you're in a jurisdiction that no longer allows online sports betting.
I have encountered people who claim to have beaten that system and been able to gamble online for Wisconsin. Good or bad for them, I don't know. But I'm guessing there are some loopholes that the technologically savvy can find.
Right. Well, it used to be, so this was the case with online poker for a long time, and there was this cafe on the side of a bridge in New Jersey that was notorious, where people would just drive over from New York and sit there in this cafe all day playing poker 50 feet from the state border, then drive back home in the evening. So maybe your friends in Wisconsin are basically doing the Midwestern version of that.
Okay, now let's get to the fallout from this 2018 decision. As you mentioned, 30-plus states go effectively all in on gambling. This happened, as you describe in the book, pretty quickly in a lot of states. What did that process look like?
We're soon this year going to have 39 different sports gambling states, so we have 39 different stories. But in general, it looked like states starting with Delaware, 6 weeks after the Supreme Court decision, rolling out retail, so in person, you know, at a sports book, sports betting, followed by, you know, maybe a year or two later, online sports betting. And just to provide sort of a frame of reference, it took us 30, 40 years of state lotteries to get to almost 40 states. And we're going to hit our 39th state in a matter of in just 7 years later this year. So it rolled out extremely quickly. And again, subject to local conditions. And in many states, it was the companies, the gambling companies that came in, that wrote gambling legislation, that drafted the regulations to the govern gambling. And they were responsible or partly responsible for getting the games up quickly and for getting the games designed in such a way that suited the interests of the sports books.
Let's look at some of the things that have changed. You mentioned those efforts to pass that law in Congress. Some of the organizations most opposed to legalized sports gambling were the sports organization, the NFLs and Major League Baseball and things like that. Now anybody who watches sports sees official partner gambling agencies. How did we get this 180?
Yeah, so this is we got the 180 slowly and then all at once. You know, back in 2014, Adam Silver, the commissioner of the NBA, wrote a sort of landmark op-ed in the New York Times calling for a reversal of PASPA, calling for a new approach when it comes to legalized sports gambling. But sort of as you're alluding to, as long as sports gambling was illegal or was not legal, the leagues could not endorse it. And they, in fact, spent many years, many decades punching down at gambling and talking about how much they dislike gambling, how much of a threat gambling is to the integrity of their game. But then lo and behold, come 10:01 a.m. on May 14th, 2018, they are yet another institution that is able to go all in on gambling, because if gambling is going to be legal, then they can make money off of it. They will make money off of it, and they can use it to drive interest in their product. So the complete 180 is now, oh, not gambling is a threat to the integrity of our product, but by giving gambling a nice bear hug, by keeping it as close to our product as possible, and by we can monitor it, we can be safe about it, we can detect if an athlete is betting or not, and by the way, we can make billions of dollars on it every single year.
Talking to Jonathan Cohen about his new book, Losing Big, America's Reckless Bet on Sports Gambling. Jonathan, let's turn to the people now making the bets. One of the arguments for legalization that you highlight being made over the years in the book is, hey, people are gambling already. They're gambling illegally. That's bad. States are getting a taste of that. They might have criminal retribution if they don't pay their debts. It's going to be safer and happier and more lucrative for everybody if it's legal. The idea is, okay, these legal things are just taking all that illegal business and transferring it over. Has that been the case, or have we seen gambling expand because of this?
So it has sort of been the case. We have absolutely, with no doubt, seen gambling expand, meaning there are lots of people, particularly young people, who were not betting before 2018 or not betting before legalization, who have only gotten into the game because it's so accessible, because they can bet in many states on their phone, you know, using a credit card, using a debit card. So first of all, already you see sort of the holes in the argument where you're getting a new generation of gamblers, you know, again, specifically young people on board. And then you're also seeing this curious phenomenon where the legal market is not actually displacing the illegal market in many instances. You know, bookies, for example, will let you bet on credit. You don't need to front every dollar for every bet. You can just call them up and say, hey, I want, you know, $10,000 on the bucks or whatever. And, you know, they'll break your kneecaps if you don't pay, but you don't have to actually give them $10,000 on the spot. And for offshore casinos too, you know, it's nice for big volume bettors. Come tax season, they don't have to report any of their winnings. So I'm not saying these are good behaviors or that we should endorse the black market, but it was sort of naive of politicians, and it was a little surreptitious of the companies to claim that all of this illegal money will automatically sort of magically appear in legal coffers without any consideration of why people actually are choosing to play on the black market.
And then there's the access to what people bet on. And when you think of sports betting, you think, I'm going to bet on the football game, right? This team's going to win, or this team's going to cover the spread, or whatever, or the over-under, whatever the case may be. Now You can go online and, you know, hey, I'm going to bet on the 10th match in this tennis tournament in Hong Kong, right, at 3 in the morning.
Rob, you're a huge Malaysian women's doubles badminton fan. Right,
exactly. I can't get enough information here, frankly. Yeah, but it's you can literally go on and bet on anything, any sporting event going on anywhere in the world, it seems like.
Yeah, and even more to the point, not just any sporting event in the world, but also any sort of fractional event in a sporting event. So you're watching the Packers game, and it's not just, you know, who's going to win the game, but like, will this drive end in a touchdown? Will the next play be a running play? Will the next play be a running play for more than 1.5 yards? And the thesis behind all of this, the idea behind all of this, is to create as many opportunities for action as possible. People who are addicted to gambling, especially, but even people who are not, you know, they're not just looking to win money. They're looking for chances to get money down and things to bet on and ways to create excitement. So what you're doing is, you know, by offering Malaysian women's doubles badminton bets, you know, you're giving people in the middle of the night who have nothing else to watch, no sports on, a chance to bet on something. And then you're also giving an incentive to bet on the Packers game, but then to keep your DraftKings app open and to keep betting over the course of the game, because any single play, any single moment in the game could be an opportunity to win money or to bet money. And that is what and this is so beyond what was imagined in 2018 when the Supreme Court, decided this issue, and it is a new frontier, absolutely, in American gambling.
And Jonathan, that takes us to the most heartbreaking parts of your books, what you call an epidemic of problem gambling. You point out not everybody who gambles, most people who gamble, won't have an addiction, but there's been a growth in gambling addiction since this happened. What are we seeing?
Yeah, so the data on this is a little uncertain, so I'll caveat it with that. But there's a lot of anecdotal evidence, especially that young people, in particularly young men, are either developing, you know, full-on gambling addictions, or at least engaging in what you could call hazardous or problematic or at-risk play, where they are, you know, periodically losing more money than they can afford, losing more money than they intend, you know, developing these sort of episodic gambling addiction where, you know, you might not have a real full-blown gambling addiction for the rest of your life, but you sort of go through a weird six-month period where you come out of the rabbit hole and you're just like, what just happened? Like, how did I just lose $15,000 over the course of 6 months? So you're seeing a lot of, again, sort of anecdotal evidence of that from high school teachers who reach out to me, from gambling therapists, from people who run gambling hotlines, all reporting not just an increase in use of their service and an increased interest in therapy and in treatment, but particularly a new demographic that it is now younger people, again, younger men in particular, more than before, who are taking advantage of these services and who need treatment for gambling-related harms.
You share a couple stories, and one that you go through the book with. We meet Kyle. You call him Kyle in the book. Share a little bit of his story and how he really descended into problem gambling.
Yeah, and he sort of embodies this sort of episodic character where he had been to a casino a couple times in his life, and it was fine. You know, he bet safely. He didn't get over his skis. You know, he was able to bet, you know, responsibly. And then Colorado legalized sports gambling in 2020. And he got really excited. He downloaded every different app and he fell into one of these rabbit holes that I mentioned of, you know, losing more money than he intended. His dad needed to bail him out. But then he kept falling down. And every time there'd be a major tennis tournament, he would, you know, go 40 hours without sleeping because he'd stay up all night to watch the games or to watch the matches. And he lost his job because of it. He had to move back in with his parents in Kansas. And, you know, even when I talked to him for the book, he's still, every time there's a major tennis tournament, he sort of it happens all over again. He until recently didn't have a source of income and sort of saw this as a way to make money. Of course, he doesn't actually make money. Many gamblers have this false sense that they're making money when they aren't. And by his own admission, he would never have been gambling, not to mention gambling on minor league British darts at 3 a.m, if it wasn't available on his phone, you know, at the touch of a button. And this is these are the consequences of not just legalized sports gambling, but the ways we have rolled it out and the ways that we've rolled it out so quickly and we've rolled it out online in particular so quickly.
And one of the biggest criticisms I've seen, not just in your book, but elsewhere of the online sports books is the lack of sufficient efforts, people would say, to find people like Kyle and keep them from gambling because they are a really solid source of revenue for these companies. What kind of safeguards do exist? What could improve things?
So there are a couple safeguards in place, but not really. I mean, the safeguards that are in place, for example, are for real sports betting, for technical sports betting. You know, you need to prove that you're over 18 or that you're over 21. Some states don't let you bet with credit cards and so on. But the vast majority of these guardrails are optional. You know, you have the option of setting up a deposit limit. You have the option of setting up a time limit on the app. And you know, as you can imagine, the companies like it that way. The companies like it that it's optional, that it's up to you, the gambler, not this billion-dollar sportsbook, to set a limit for yourself and to define what responsible play is for you. And that's why advocates like myself and lawmakers have called for making some of these guardrails required. You know, if you deposit money into your account, you can't gamble with it right away. You have to wait 24 hours or 12 hours so that you can't start chasing all of your losses. The companies could do this themselves, and I wish they would, and that they would self-regulate, but it doesn't seem like they're going to, which is, again, why it has sort of fallen to people outside of the private sector to call for making them required to protect people like Kyle and prevent them from falling into these harms in the first place.
But it's kind of the opposite thing happens. I think it was Kyle gets VIP treatment. There are staff at some of these sports books who say, hey, this person looks like they're going to spend a lot of money. We want to make sure they keep spending a lot of money with us. And so we're going to give them some perks and things like that and keep them betting. How does that VIP system work?
Yeah, it's exactly as you described, whereas they, you know, these companies have more data on their gamblers than any gambling operation in recorded human history. And they can figure out who is going to bet, how much they're going to bet, and who might, you know, if with a little human nudges, right, with someone in their ear offering them tickets to a football game, you know, a free iPhone, you name it, to incentivize them to play more. And then also to build brand loyalty and to say, oh, you know, if you're betting a lot of money, we want you to bet all of it with FanDuel. You know, we don't want you to go to these other sports books and we'll reward you. We'll give you trophies. We'll give you this. We'll give, you know, and you can imagine how much someone has to be losing, how much money they have to be gambling away in order for that to be a profitable enterprise for the companies. But, you know, this has been a longstanding practice in the casino industry, and it's now even worse, I think, with sports betting because you can bet from your phone. You don't have to be at the casino, right, to be losing money. You can be doing it any single minute of the day, betting on Malaysian women's doubles badminton.
You mentioned the need for more safeguards for problem gamblers and other changes in the industry. Who would that have to come from, assuming it's not going to come from the industry itself? State by state, Congress, where?
So, yeah, either one, state or Congress. You know, of course, every state regulates, you know, per the Supreme Court decision, every state regulates its own sports gambling. And there is a state regulatory body that could say, you know, okay, the new law in Wisconsin or in Kansas or wherever is, you know, you can only gamble this much per day. You can only log into your app this number of times and so on. States, as we've talked about, sort of make money from sports gambling and are often loath to pull back on the way that gambling has been rolled out. So there is a bill, as you've already described, in Congress that would do exactly what we've been talking about, which is sort of set a floor under sports gambling, meaning, okay, states, you can offer sports gambling, but you need to limit advertising in this way. You need to spend this much money on problem gambling. You need to ban the use of AI to develop specialized player tools or player props to try to entice players and so on. So it could come from the state. It could come from Congress. I'm a little skeptical it's ever going to come from either, but I'm hopeful.
Jonathan, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, Rob. Good luck.
That is Jonathan D. Cohn. He talked with Rob Ferret about his new book, Losing Big, America's Reckless Bet on Sports Gambling.